All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fuckadelics? What the fucking fucks? Oh, that kind of drove that into a ditch, didn't I? That didn't work out, did it? Huh? No, it did not. Today on the show, Justin McKinney. He's a comic that started a little bit after me in Boston. He's got a new comedy special, Justin McKinney, Parentally Challenged. It's available on Amazon Prime and iTunes. You can go to justinmckinney.com. But I remember this guy because years ago, he used to be a cop. And years ago, he was with my first agent, Showbiz Talk. And he, you know, he had a couple of deals and he did some stuff and he was a cop and she had another guy who was a transit cop. There was a couple of cops around doing comedy, but his story, I didn't know it, but I'd run into him up in New Hampshire when I played up there and we talked for a while and I thought it would be interesting, and it is. So he's on the show. Also, wanted to tell you people in San Francisco, Sword of Trust, the movie that I've been talking ad nauseum about, because I'm in it, and I think it's funny. Look, I do a lot of things, people, and you know, I think you know me by now. There are times where I won't plug myself. You know why? Because I forget. There's a theater there in the Castro called No, it's not in the Castro. That's the Castro Theater. The Roxy is just, I believe, let's play this game. Does Mark have memories of San Francisco? I believe the Roxy is somewhere on 16th and Valencia. In the Mission-ish. That's what I'm thinking. Can I get someone to check that, please? I'll wait. Oh, I guess I got to check. Hold on a second. Yep. Uh-huh. On Valencia. Yep. Six. I did it. My memory worked. Oh, my God. Play the music. Play the music. Memory's not so great. So that's on the 4th and 8th. August 4th and 8th at the Roxy Theater. There's only two screenings, and it's a nice little theater, and I'm just giving you the heads up to go. Getting a lot of good feedback for the movie. I'm proud of the movie. I think it's funny, and it's not just me that's funny. The whole fucking thing is funny. And eventually I'll stop talking about it in this little phase of my life where everybody's excited and there's fancy reviews in the New Yorker and the New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Trib, Variety, just, you know, everybody raving about this thing. A month from now, I'll just feel like none of it ever happened. But for the time being, I would go see it. Glow, the third season of Glow, which I'm on, I play a role on that show. Glow drops August 9th. And you know what else happens August 9th? I am 20 years sober. Am I gloating? Maybe a little. Am I humble about it? Not really. 20 fucking years. I did it. But it's not done, day at a time. And I do, in all honesty, I do get a lot of email from people who are struggling with this stuff. It is possible, and life does get better. Look, I'm dealing with the end of the world fine. I don't have to drink over it. I can eat over it. I can jerk off over it. I'll jerk off all over the end of the world. All over it. Yeah, that's how I win. But I don't have to drink over it. Okay? You got to do what you got to do. Intentional cognitive dissonance. Some people call it belief. Yet, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to know what's going on. Hey, it's awfully hot. You know, I can barely breathe out here. That's all right. Things are okay. Just go to the gym. The intentional cognitive dissonance. There's something rich about that area of thought where you're aware of the horror, but yet you still have to have a life. So tonight, I'm going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina. Theoretically, I'm here, but I'm not really, because this is like a day or two before. It's just the way this is going right now. But I can't tell you I'm excited because I'm renting a car in North Carolina, and I got a thing for pottery. I think some of you know that. I just do. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's an old hippie thing. Maybe it's an authenticity thing. Maybe it's just the sort of fundamentals of craftsmanship and the individuality of the process and the sort of ancient art of it all. But I like nice pottery or just practical pottery. I just like pots that are thrown by hand or mashed and made anyway. I just like ceramics. And somebody hit me to this area in North Carolina called Seagrove. I know nothing about it, but they were just sort of like, you got to go to Seagrove for pottery. I did a little research. It seems like a good deal of the handmade pottery coming out of the United States comes out of this area. I don't know why. I didn't do that kind of research. I don't know if it's the clay is good there or what, but I'm going to take a trip out there because I've got this dream, folks. I've got a pottery dream. I got a pottery vision. I've got this large cabinet in my house that has a glass front to it. It's an old Craftsman built-in. And I think at one time it might have been used for china or fancy stuff. But in my vision, it's filled with all kinds of uniquely individual pieces of hand-thrown pottery. Cups, large bowls, maybe a stack of plates, maybe a pitcher or two that theoretically I would collect over a lifetime. But I don't know if that, I think it's a little late for that. Because I haven't been collecting pottery for a lifetime, but I'm going to buy a lifetime's worth of pottery in Seagrove, North Carolina. That's my plan. I don't even know what they have there, but I in my dream, I'm going to go from place to place, maybe 97 places, 92, maybe 6, 12, 19, and I might go to a 20th, but I think I've got enough. I played that out. But I figure I can get a lifetime's worth of pottery and even make up a big lie about my experience accumulating it over a lifetime from one trip to Seagrove. So if you're a potter in Seagrove, let me know and I'll come by and check your shit out because I'm going to do that. I think I'm probably going to do it tomorrow, Friday. I don't know. I don't know. I've got some touching emails here. I got one. Subject line, two of us. Hey, Mark. I just wanted to reach out to you with a story about my dad. Hopefully you have time to read this. I'll try to make it short. Don't worry, this isn't entirely random. It involves you too. He passed last winter, and today would have been his birthday. A long time ago, in an administration far, far away, I started listening to WTF around episode 400-something. I enjoy the way you often approach interviews as a fan and try to figure out where the fuck people come from. Around this time, my father was getting older, and as a complication of diabetes, his vision started disappearing due to cataracts. Since the healthcare in this country was and still is pretty what the fuck, it took over a year to get him in for the most routine surgery in America so he could see again. During that time, he was getting pretty bummed out, not being able to drive, work, or anything. So I recommended this cool podcast I was listening to. He didn't know what a podcast was, but he did recognize your name. He'd always liked you as a comic. I got him set up, and he had enough peripheral vision to navigate the app and go on neighborhood walks. He really bit in, Mark. Within a week, he had subscribed and was chewing through the back catalog, telling me stories from episodes I had missed, and spending the day walking around with you in his head. His mood was massively improved by getting to engage with you and your guests. It was a perfect thing for him in that moment, and I got to share something I was really excited about and experience it together with him. Through the years, we geeked out about big celebrities like Obama and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and we would replay some of the, and he would replay some of the showcase songs on repeat. When I went through his phone one last time this winter, I saw he had also still been listening. He got to hear your interview with Sir Paul, who was one of his favorite people in the universe. Anyway, I miss my dad, but I thought it might brighten the world a little bit to remember a time when we all made each other happy. Thanks, Mark. Justin. Thank you, Justin. Thank you for sharing that because it's important. These are important things, you know? Try to, and this is coming from me, and those of you who've been listening a long time, if you're old and your parents are still alive and they're really old and you're holding on to something, if it's not that bad, you know, get over it and try to, you know, appreciate the time they have left. That's all. This one's funny, a little dark, but I think Donald would appreciate it. Subject line, I didn't think you would ever come around. God, it makes me so mad when Donald is right about this sort of shit. Still, glad you did come around. If I was still alive, I'd love to be on the show. Cheers, the ghost of Walter Becker. Is that wrong? Come on. I think it's pretty funny. Okay, look, let's get on with it. I'll be in Raleigh tonight. Go to WTFpod.com/tour. There's a lot of dates coming up. Austin, Houston, Dallas, Detroit, San Francisco, D.C., Atlanta, Minneapolis, Chicago, Nashville, Philadelphia. A lot of stuff coming up. And I didn't even mention some. There's more. Look. All right. So Justin McKinney, as I said before, I knew him as a comic. He started a little bit after me, the generation after me in Boston. He was a cop. And it's, you know, it's a unique story. And you know, I ran into him in New Hampshire when I did a gig there a couple years ago, and we decided we would do this, and he was here, and we did it. He's got a new comedy special called Justin McKinney, Parentally Challenged. You can get it on Amazon Prime, iTunes. You can go to his website at justinmckinney.com. And this is me talking to New Hampshire's own Justin McKinney. So Justin, I noticed that you spell your name peculiarly. Why? What is that name, Justin, with an O?
It's
I just noticed that today when I went to Google search.
You just noticed.
Yeah, I put in Justin like a regular spelling.
Normal, yeah.
And then it comes up Justin.
Yeah, it's been a curse, and I've talked about it on stage because it's such a curse, especially now with social media.
Well, I'm Mark with a C. Yeah, people, I know.
But at least if you say, and part of what I talk about is if you say Mark with a C, you know where the C goes, right? It goes at the end of your name.
Sure, you go Justin with an O.
They don't know where it is, so people go J-O-S-T-I-N. Like, no one knows where the O is supposed to go.
Right.
So I really have to say Justin, J-U-S-T-O-N. I have to spell the whole name out.
What is the history of the Justin with an O? Where does that come from?
Do you want to, all honesty, I asked my dad about, I don't know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, because it's a huge pain in my ass. And he told me, this is a true story, he goes, because you were born just on time.
Come on.
I swear to God, that's what he tells me. My dad is like trying to be the funny guy. Right? Just on, and I literally, so on stage, I'll talk about it. I'll go, it could have been just in time. It's the same dumb joke. Yeah. Like, he got the joke wrong.
Yeah.
And he did that to me. And it's been a nightmare. I'm not even lying. Like, if I say to people, oh, follow me on Instagram, if I don't tell you how to spell my name and you search Justin with an I, like, you on Instagram, the Instagram search will not find me.
Right.
So, no. It's not like someone's going to be like, you know what, I really got to find that guy. Let me try again.
Right.
People aren't going to try twice.
Right.
So it's become a little bit, I really believe social media, I would have 50% more followers if my name was spelled with an I.
And we couldn't have foreseen these problems.
No, he couldn't have. He couldn't have. And you know what the worst part is?
More, it's not like they didn't give you enough obstacles to deal with. Now the name bites you in the ass.
My dad texts me, but he'll spell it with an I. It drives me nuts.
Because of the spell check.
I don't know if it's because of the spell check. Yeah?
Of course.
All right.
What do you think he's correct doing?
I don't know. It just annoys me.
No, of course it's like, a spell check. He just doesn't like it. It's hard on the texting when you want to correct spell check. It's a pain in the ass. Like, who uses the word ducking that much? When you put fucking in, it's always going to correct the ducking. But it's like that. Right. Why? Just put fucking in. I think you can program your phone to use the words that you want, can't you?
To learn it. I think so, but I don't know how to do that either.
So I'm trying to figure out when, like, you're not my generation of Boston. You're like the one after me, right?
Yeah. I started with like Bill Burr and Patrice O'Neill, Gary Gulman. Those guys were all kind of down there, mid-90s.
Okay, yeah, because I was there in 88. I started working. I came in second in the riot in 88. Yep. And you started working 90 what?
It was like the mid-90s.
Really?
Yeah, 93. I mean, the first time I ever went on stage,
I forget
was
how old I am. Early... I'm just old. I'm like an old guy now. The weird thing about Boston, and like, I think it's a little different than when I started there, is that there is a, like, I don't know, if it's not the word indigenous, but there is a regional comedy network business where guys who, they never leave there.
Yep.
And it's always been that way. Now, I'm not putting you in that category or saying that you chose to be that category, but it is a real thing that there was, I think it's really the only place like that where you could go when I started and you could make a living doing comedy at one-nighters for life, it used to be. So there were guys like, you know, that's how I started, but I think it's the only part of the country where that really is the case. You can live in Boston, and at the time there was like, God knows, maybe 100-150 one-nighters where you could go out and work as a comic.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to make a living now just doing the Boston scene.
Yeah.
A lot of guys have second jobs. Like a lot,
really?
Of, a lot of the headlines that are headlining the one-nighters and stuff, a lot of them have second jobs.
Uh-huh.
I've been lucky to do, I do theaters up in the Portsmouth Music Hall where
sure.
I saw you
yeah.
that night in Portsmouth last. Like that's one that I do. So I try to do some of those, which make it work for me up there. Where I don't need another job, but it's
right.
but it's tough to do. It's not like it used to be. We joke that the money in the middle money back in the day was
yeah.
was more than headliner money now.
But there wasn't even middles when I was coming up in Boston. It was a two-man show. You'd
yeah.
go out with a guy that you'd have to drive usually, or meet there, do a half hour,
yeah.
they'd do 45, and you're out.
Yes.
George McDonald will juggle angrily, and you're gone.
George McDonald. Oh, my gosh.
I used to love when he'd take out those balls because he knew he didn't want to take out those balls.
I didn't even know him. I didn't even know he did the balls.
He does. When he has to, he used to. When he had to do 45, he'd do about 35 of material, and then he'd take that little bag out with the balls, and it wasn't even that spectacular juggling, but
oh.
it was just sort of like, I got to close with the, here come the balls.
I've got a George McDonald story.
Oh, really? Nice guy. One of the greatest guys.
Great guy. I was, when I had just started, my dad, and I didn't know, we might have got into all this, but my dad was a homeless alcoholic for many years.
We're going to get into that, yeah.
He was, was the town, drunk, right?
Yeah.
He was the drunk guy.
What
in,
town?
Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Oh, right.
Living on the streets.
So you've been there, so you're still there. You stayed there.
I was, so one night, I'm just starting to do stand-up. I'd only been in two or three
yeah.
years, and there was a show in Portsmouth at this place. I was in the middle spot, and George was headlining.
Yeah. No balls?
I don't remember balls.
All right.
I don't, but maybe this is why I didn't remember balls. So I do my 20 minutes, whatever I did, and I knew everybody in the room.
Yeah.
I knew everybody came, because I'm from there. And the show went okay. I get off stage. While George is on, my dad, who weighs 140 pounds, long gray hair, gray beard, really skinny, walks up on stage and tries to grab the mic out of George McDonald's hands.
Shit-faced. Yeah.
Goes to grab the mic. The bouncers come up and grab my dad and drag him off. And George McDonald just looks right over and just says, huh, looks like Santa went on a binge this year. Huge laugh, bigger than any laugh I got.
Yeah.
And that was me starting stand-up.
Did you tell him it was your dad?
They all knew it was my dad.
Oh, because
they
town.
Knew me. They knew it was my dad. Like that was. But when you say George McDonald, it's like
that's your
boom,
memory.
That's immediately what I think of. And that line he came up with was great. And I had to laugh. But I used to get annoyed. With my dad, that would annoy me. I'd always worry about that happening.
That's
since I was a kid. That embarrassment.
Highly annoying. George McDonald used to host the open mic when I was in college at Stitches. It was called Comedy Hell, and he was the guy that a lot of us first started doing open mics with because he hosted one, and it was just a nightmare of a show. He was great and always nice and supportive, but it was small audiences, and he called it Comedy Hell, and he would play it up.
Yeah, that was the first place I was on stage, Stitches.
The original one in the Paradise?
The one near Fenway.
Ugh, that place was terrible. That one near Fenway, used to be another place before that was cursed. That little block right there across from Father's Two, it used to be a fucking horrible bar no one went into called The Ark. And you just walk by it. I lived there. I was in college here for 4 years. I never set foot in the fucking place. Like, who goes in there? And then it becomes Stitches. Oh, man. Yeah, and you had to walk all the way in the back, and there was that back room. It seemed like it would be nice, but I'm telling you, there was something about that location.
Yeah,
so Portsmouth, I feel like there was a gig up there when I was coming up that maybe Robin Horton booked. What was the gig in Portsmouth? I know there was a gig there.
I think you're thinking of, I just had it in my head, the one in Portsmouth. Oh, the Speakeasy.
Yeah, that's it.
It was a roller skating rink.
That's it. They used to have a one-nighter there?
Yeah, that's what I actually saw Joe Rogan there was opening for Vinny Favorito.
Oh, my
way
God.
Way back in the day.
That's it. That was it. The
yes,
Speakeasy.
The Speakeasy. Was it called that?
I don't remember.
It was a roller skating rink.
Yeah, that was, but that
and
is
then
such
they did comedy, I think, on the off nights, maybe?
In the bar area?
Yes.
That, I mean, those were the gigs. Saying that like it shouldn't even shock me, and it doesn't. Oh, yeah, it was a roller skating rink. That's the point. That's it. And the weird thing is, I don't remember it being a roller skating rink. But I remember there was a gig up there. It's
yeah,
fucked up.
Yeah.
But that was how we did it back then. So you start in Boston. So now, okay, let's get into the, because I don't know Portsmouth. Is it Portsmouth?
Portsmouth. Yep.
It's spelled Portsmouth, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't, I know New Hampshire, and I know it from driving up there, and it's pretty. But I remember, I'm pretty sure, like, there were a couple of cops. You and Joe DiResta, right?
John.
John DiResta.
John DiResta, yes.
Was a Boston cop.
He was a NYPD transit cop.
Oh, he was a New York transit cop.
Yes.
Right, and he got a deal with my old agent, Ruthann Secunda.
Who was my old agent.
She was the one. She was the one that would get you the first deal, and then that was it.
She changed my life and ruined my life.
So you were a cop. So you're growing up in Portsmouth. Like what's the situation? How many siblings do you have?
Three brothers.
Really? Older?
One younger, two older.
Yeah.
And my dad.
Yeah.
And my mom passed away when I was six.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And when I was living in Portsmouth, I was going to elementary school there.
So wait, now your brothers are older?
Two older, one younger.
All right. So there's four of you, and your mom passed away?
Mom passed away.
What happened?
Brain aneurysm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Just out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah, because I was with her. She was volunteering at a school fair. It was one, you know, when they have the balloons, the tables, all the,
oh,
you know, the games.
God. Yeah.
Yeah, and she just collapsed and like started holding her head and was screaming, and yeah, I was right there. And they put her in the ambulance.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was 2 months ago I went back to that elementary school. I hadn't been back. Well, I hadn't been back since I left. I was there through fifth grade.
Yeah.
But I haven't been back since I've, you know, been an adult. And, you know, the weirdest thing is I go to see my mom's grave.
Yeah.
And from the gravesite, the school's right there.
Oh, my God.
Like, you see the grave, the school's right there. So I just pulled into the school and I just walked. It hasn't changed. I just looked in the window like that's the spot. You know,
really?
And I haven't since my whole life is the first time I've gone back.
Like, and it's right, it's in town though? It's right in town?
It's just off town a little bit, but it's just the lobby area. The doors were locked. I just went in and I kind of looked in and like that was the area the tables were. That's where she fell. And
oh,
I don't know what
God.
Drew me to that. I went to see her grave and I just saw the school and I'm like, oh, let me take a ride over. So yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so, it's sad.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, and my dad, you know, was left with, you know, the four kids, you know what I mean?
What did he do?
That generation. He had a telephone answering service at the time, which was, you know, before pagers and cell phones, you know, the old switchboard kind.
Sure. So like if a doc was on call or something.
Yeah,
after hours.
Yep. He ran that and he was big into, he was buying real estate. You know,
in Portsmouth?
Yeah, he owned a bunch of, at one time, he owned a bunch of properties.
I mean,
if he could have held it together, it would have been worth a lot of money.
What happened to the properties?
He just lost them all through, you know, not managing it, not paying taxes. I mean, he lost the house I lived in. You know what I mean? Eventually, so it just went, you know.
Well, so you guys are doing okay for a while.
Well, my aunt moves in,
your mom's sister.
Ends up with my dad. Like, they ended up in a relationship.
From the get-go, or just, like, she stepped in to help the kids?
She stepped in to help, and you know, and she definitely kept things together, right? The glue, you know, to make sure we have power and, you know, electricity and water and all that stuff. And they ended up in a relationship. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And how old were you when you knew that was happening?
I was probably, like, eight, 9 years old.
Did it just seem natural, or was it weird, or...?
It was definitely weird. I mean, I was aware that I was living a little bit different than my friends, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't the same.
Did they get married?
They never got married.
No. But it just sort of happened.
It just happened, and my dad drank, and she drank, and the fighting.
Drinking was always part of it.
Drinking was something, and I used to joke that, you know, having two... You know, alcoholics is like having two dogs. They keep each other company.
Right.
A lot of times they were fighting, so...
They're actually giving away together when you go pick them up at the shelter.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're going to take the man, you got to take his wife.
Yeah.
Because they belong together.
That's right. You want two of them.
Yeah, you got to have two
in
the house.
Trust me, you're going to want two of them. One alcoholic, no good.
No good because it'll drain the whole family.
Yeah.
Two, they beat the shit out of each other and it works out.
Yeah, they distracted. You'll thank us.
Yeah. So, okay, so they're that's going on right away. Your dad was always boozy.
I remember it from the time I can remember, yes. I believe that losing his wife, she was 29 years old, having the four kids, I mean, I believe that didn't help, right? That probably, so he...
Was this a Catholic situation?
No.
Just they just kept coming, the kids.
Yeah, it was just, they did, you know, in... I don't know this, but I had heard that, you know, birth control might have been what caused. Remember, you know, the dose, that's one of the side effects is blood
aneurysms.
I think back then it was like the dose, and I think maybe.
Really?
I remember hearing that at one point. So
that's possible.
So I think I think four was enough.
I think it was smoking and birth control pills. Like, you know, did she smoke?
She did.
Mm.
Yeah. I think she did.
I think that, we could research this, but there's no time now.
No.
But that sort of sticks in my head that if you smoked on certain birth control at that time, either way, it's sad. So your dad, he's broken up about it, and the drinking got worse right away, or was it always kind of there? What?
It was there. It's like, you know, I could remember, you know, every night, you know, he'd sit and sip out of a little shot glass in the dark, kind of by himself.
One
you know,
of
that
those guys.
Of, yeah. Listen to the police scanner. Very paranoid, you know.
Really?
Listen to the police scanner. Yeah.
For what?
Well,
they were coming to get
him? He would get in trouble a lot. Yeah, my dad had history.
When did the business start to? When did it all start to fall apart? I mean, you were six and things were okay, right?
He had, yeah. I think there was drinking then too.
Sure.
From what I'd heard, like, yeah. I think it was still there. But yes, things definitely started to go off the rails after that. The business was, I don't know how well the business did. After fifth grade, we moved right over the bridge into Kittery, Maine, right after elementary school.
Yeah.
So I just moved over there. So I would have been sixth or seventh grade. He got mad at the bank for not giving him a loan or something.
Yeah.
So he went down there in the middle of the day and threw a brick through the front window of the bank.
Hmm.
So it's like that kind of stuff, like through my childhood, there's always worried that what was he going to do to embarrass me? Like there was that I lived with a lot. Like I didn't want anyone at school or friends to know. And true story, my friend Alan lived across the street from the bank and he called me up and like saw it happen. He goes, "Is your dad home?" And I'm like, I think I just saw him throw a brick through the bank in his underwear. He says, and the joke part of me, it goes to, he said he had some errands to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You said he had some errands to run. But he was, but then the cops would come to the house. They would look for them. One time they had to raise the drawbridge because it was over the river, like so that he wouldn't like escape to the. So there was a lot of that growing up. That kind
so
of
he
stuff.
Would sit and drink alone listening to the police scanner to see if they were coming to get him.
I believe so. And he would go up, if he thought he heard his name, he would go out in the back up in the woods. Like I remember that happening.
Really?
So there was, yes. And let me just say, he's been sober for 11 years now. I gave him his 10-year chip. I just want to say that now. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he's, so, you know, so if anyone's listening going, you know,
You can say it's possible to recover.
I mean, we thought he was going to die on the streets. There's no doubt about it. So after I got out of high school, he lost the house and all that and left my aunt. I mean, I think
Did he ever do jail time?
Oh, he went to jail a lot. Yeah, like just like a lot of overnights, protective custody and that kind of stuff. Like, you know, you drinking and driving. He was arrested for drunk driving at 8 in the morning while on his way to court for drunk driving.
Yeah.
Like that's, I mean, that kind of stuff.
I was just hiking this morning and I was coming down the mountain. This is at 8 o'clock in the morning and I saw two dudes. One of them had a big thing of water. The other one had a six pack and they were hiking up the mountain at 8 in the morning. And I thought like, well, you know, at least they're not driving. You know what I mean?
Yes.
If you're going to, you're going to morning drink, yeah, take a hike.
Yeah. I mean, my dad's lucky he didn't kill anybody. And that was a huge fear as a kid. We're talking drinking. I mean, he would have a screwdriver in the cup holder, like in drive. Back then, they were drinking and drive. They would actually drink and drive.
Right.
I mean, they weren't even, not they were just drunk. They're drinking while they're driving.
Sure.
So that was just, yeah.
So when you graduate high school, then the relationship with your aunt falls apart and what? And
yeah,
then,
once all the kids grew up, he lost the house. He didn't pay the taxes. It was boarded up. For a while, it was literally a bunch of, I'd say, derelicts or homeless people all living in there.
With
like,
him?
Doing drugs and drinking.
Was he there,
he
too?
He was still there, yep. And it was there was a fire, like, in one of the bedrooms, and they just took, we had this pool that was in the back that hadn't been open for years.
Yeah.
And they would scoop water up with buckets and put the fire out themselves. Never called the fire department. It was
and
a
your
really,
dad was still living there?
He was still there at the time. This is when he was going definitely downhill, on his way to homelessness. This is when he was...
So... But this is a small town, like you said, right? So, you know, he's notorious. I mean, the guy...
They love him, and everybody loves him.
Really?
All the town all loves him. You know, people would bump into me, like, your dad's the best. You know, your dad's... And in the back of my head, there's a little part of me going, yeah, you know, I love my dad, and my dad is my biggest fan in the world. So,
now.
Yes. And I think he always was
a
fan, but it's just, it was just, it's a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to look at what he... you know, the four kids and being left with that, and that kind of triggered it, and then this all goes. But
did everybody turn out all right? I mean, how did it, how many?
Yeah, I think we we're doing good. Yeah, yeah. I think we're doing good. Yeah,
and you never got the bug.
I drink socially. You know,
Did you go the other way? Did you go the control freak path?
I went the other way in the sense I became a cop. You know.
Oh God!
I mean, he didn't like cops, and part of the reason that made me such a good cop
right.
was because I treated I got hired at 19, by the way, youngest cop I think they'd ever hired up there, and I was really mature for my in the interview.
Well,
I
you got to be when you're living in chaos.
You got to
go pick your dad up at the fucking jail.
I had to, I remember saying to them that, you know, I treat everybody like you're my dad, and my whole family, by the way, have all run-ins with cops. But anyway, like you're my dad, and you don't like cops, how I want to change your mind. Like, that was really how I went about it. I never had that big badge, the power, never had that. I was always de-escalating. Now, mind you, it was in rural Maine. There were two of us for 500 square miles. So you had no backup. When you have no backup, you learn to de-escalate. You know, you didn't, you know.
But also, I'd imagine that most of those calls are domestic issues, right?
Yeah, a lot of domestic issues. And, you know, my dad would fight with the police. Like, we saw him get pepper sprayed, I mean, right in our living room. I mean, this kind of stuff. So when I could remember going to domestics thinking, this guy's going to attack me.
Yeah.
And then very few people attack you. It's very rare. Like, I thought that was the norm.
At least one of them's grateful you showed up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, to de-escalate. They probably wanted to de-escalate, I would think, a lot of times.
A lot of times, yeah.
But what's the impulse? I mean, do you remember when you decided to be a cop? Like, I mean...
I do.
What drove that?
Well, I definitely Chips was like one of my favorite shows growing up. Chips,
sure.
And I had such an ethical mind that I used to not like Ponch because he used to flirt, and I used to think that was like, you know, he's a cop. You know, I like John was like the professional, so I really was like John, right?
Right.
And by the way, when I would watch Chips, like I would be watching an episode of Chips and the real cops would show up at my house.
Come on.
Like, I'm not even lying to you. It's total. And they would come in. I remember one time the dog was loose and so the neighbors called the police about our dog being loose. So I let the cop in and I'll never forget. This cop was the nicest. He was so nice to me. He's talking to me. I'm asking him about stuff on his belt. I mean, this to me was like, oh, a policeman. He was so nice. My dad comes barreling down the stairs going, get the fuck out of the house. This cop like had to backpedal and like, all right. And he shut the door and he's like, get your dog. You got to get your dog in. And it was, and I just saw that. And I, as a little kid, I thought to myself, my dad's wrong here. Like, I mean, what's going on here? Like, who's right and who's wrong? And I didn't get it. So that was my dad's, that's what drove me to be the kind of cop that I was, because it was just, I didn't understand it. Like, I really looked, so what made me become a cop? So I was going to be a private investigator in high school, and I asked my guidance counselor to set up a job shadow with a private investigator.
Yeah.
And they couldn't find one. So they go, but we found this police officer. It was Kittery police officer. This Officer Toulouse was his name. And you want to go shadow with him, do a ride along. And I go, you know what? I'll do it because you set it up. I'll go do it. But I did not think that I was really going to become a cop. And when I left that night, that guy's crew, watching this guy, he was really professional, great, just out there talking about how, you know, if anything happens, like he's the one who's going to show up. Like,
right.
And I looked at him like they saved the day. Like, cops are good. I've always looked at it through my eyes that way. And when I got out of there, just that whole idea of serving and being out there and helping people, and he was going on calls and he's watching them. I just watched that and goes, you know what? I think I want to do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was kind of, that was it. So I went to, college and...
Where are your brothers and where are they in all this? Are you all sitting around watching TV? I mean, did they get out of the house because they were older or what?
Yeah. Well, the two that were older had kind of left and the younger one was still there and things really went downhill. So my aunt brought in two of her kids too, so there were really six kids, two cousins, my four of them.
Were they bad seeds or were they all right?
everyone was kind of all right, but two of my brothers have been, and they're great now, but two of my brothers have been arrested for resisting arrest. They fight with the cops. They like to fight cops, which I never understood this.
What do you mean? They grew up with it. It's learned behavior.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Right. So, but my aunt, I remember one day comes home, and I'm probably in high school. She goes, oh, my God, I kicked that cop right in the nuts. And I remember thinking, it was like, I mean, this is, these stories, like, my brother.
The cops were the enemy,
and it was just, and that was how I grew up, and then, you know, so I in my own little way tried to change that, you know.
But it's interesting, because of the nature of it being relatively small town and everybody knows each other, you know, the cops didn't beat the shit out of your dad.
No, they
were sort of like, this is the local, you know, drunk lunatic.
They would have to pepper spray him. Like I said, you know, and you know, I could remember, you know, one of the bumping into a cop. A lot of times I would bump into the, when I became a cop too, like I would get calls over the radio. We have a warrant of arrest. It's for your dad. Like that's, or I'd bump into a guy. I got your dad for drunk driving. He couldn't even get out of the car.
Do you want to come deal with it? They feel bad that
they had to arrest him, but they had to arrest him.
And then you'd be get on the radio and go like, all right, I'm coming.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I would get him. And when there was a warrant, I had another guy, you know, another deputy go over and, you know, get him. I talked to him.
You can't serve your dad a warrant?
I mean, I could, but it was like, I went over with the guy. I just let him take them, you know. It was like, because it just, I was, you know, it was, I was aggravated with him at that time, and you know, I couldn't be a cop.
Understandably, you don't have to feel bad about that.
In the town of Kittery, where I now was living and went to high school, I knew I couldn't be a cop there because I would be dealing with him every day. So I got hired at the sheriff's office, which patrols the York County, but the Kittery isn't one of their towns because I patrolled the small towns that didn't have their own PD.
What did your dad say when you said you were going to be a cop?
I mean, it was funny. He didn't go to my graduation, like at the police academy. He's like, are there going to be cops there? You know, I mean, it was just, he is a funny guy. And I got a lot of humor out of him because he is a funny guy. So when they hired me at the county, you have to go before county commissioners. The chief had told me that one of the commissioners brought up the fact that, you know, his dad is, you know, this guy, almost like that was going to keep me from getting hired. So I found out about that after I got hired. So that kind of stuff, it's like, all right, so imagine here I am a cop, like he's kind of getting in the way of that. And here I am going to be this really good cop, like, you know, I'd be an asset to the community, and that almost stopped me from doing that. And then when I become a stand-up, the whole George McDonald story we talked about, right? He's doing that. So there was aggravation. As much as I loved my dad, and he'd see me and be like, Justin, you. But you know, it was the annoyance of that. It was definitely aggravating.
But so when you become a cop, how long before he becomes like this homeless drunk?
It was pretty immediate because I was 19, and it was, you know, I could remember getting a call one night. He was walking over the bridge from Kittery into Portsmouth, and he got shot with a pellet gun. Someone drove by and shot him with a pellet gun. And I remember saying to my partner at the time, I'm like, the only drive-by shooting ever in Maine, and it's my dad. It hits my dad.
And it's a pellet gun.
And it's a pellet gun. And to this day, you know who my dad thinks did it?
Who?
The mob. They're using pellet guns. He thinks he was tied up with the mob. He still thinks it was some guy in the mafia, he's telling me. Because he was doing the real estate deals and all that stuff, and there were some shady characters. And he did siding, aluminum siding back in the day. He's been...
It's sort of like, the way you're framing it, it's sort of like, it's like Mayberry, as dark as Mayberry could get. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's pellet guns, town drunks, and police scares. Like, there's still an element to it where it's like, it's a sad story, but it's not a horror story.
No, and it ended well.
Thank God.
You know what I mean? It did. So looking back now, we can laugh. And I got to tell you, just a month ago, we're at my brother's house for a party. And me and my brothers all get around, and we're just talking stories about the growing up and about how we had big rats in the house. And my dad would say, well, the good thing is if you have rats, that means you got no mice. You know what I mean? Like, that was his logic. So we're going back and forth with all these stories, and my dad, right, laughing the whole time. He's such a great soul. He really is. So he's just laughing at the whole thing, and we're all laughing at it. We all love him. And then he goes, look, let me just say this. And we just stop and look at him. What's he going to say, right? And what comes in, he literally says, it wasn't as bad as it was. And we just bust out laughing. And I go, that should be a title of my book. It's like, it wasn't as bad as it was. And it was like, that's his, and he makes us laugh, and he does. And he really is a fun. And now, I mean, the wall in his house is all me, like articles. Yeah. And I mean, it's like he looks like a stalker.
So when, okay, so you're being the cop. Your dad's in and out of, I mean, you know, if he's 11 years sober, I mean, it's a pretty long run.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a long run. And, but we thought he would die on the streets. We can't believe it.
But what is the process of that? So you're a cop and your dad's this homeless drunk and there's nothing you can do. You can't get him into a shelter. You just have, there's nothing you can do. It just was the way it was.
Right. I think it's like, you know, he lived in my brother's closet, like walk-in closet for a couple of years, but he was.
For a couple of years?
For a couple of years.
Did your brother know?
Oh, yeah. That would have been great if he didn't. Oh, yeah, he knew. Yeah, he just got a little mattress pad in there, and he, like, literally was living there for a while. So we always offer it to them, like, to take him in. But at the end of the day, he had to get to that point where I want help. You know, when he went into rehab once and fell off the wagon, and then he got back in.
But everybody would serve him, you know, in town? Like, they knew him? Like,
oh, yeah.
Was he begging for money and everything?
He wasn't a beggar. Nope, he wasn't a beggar. But everybody loved him. Everybody liked him. But I could remember in the newspaper, like, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, as his kid that you'd see. They would put there was an article in the paper one day. There was a line of fans waiting for Jimmy Buffett tickets. And they called, Parrotheads, I think,
yeah.
Right? Jimmy
yeah.
Buffett fans?
Parrotheads, yeah.
And there's my dad with his, you know, homeless bag. He's, you know, he's been on the newspaper. He's, you know, cover of the paper about homeless stories and stuff. He's got this bag on his back like this. And the article said something like, the headline was something like, Parrotheads get tips from a pro. Like, on how to, like, camp outside. Like, you know what I mean? They basically were calling my dad homeless in the local paper.
Right.
Like, that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? It's like, you know.
Town drunk.
Yeah,
classic.
It was, yeah. And I remember when my sister-in-law was in town. We were out drinking in Portsmouth one night. It was about 12:30, 1 in the morning. And there's my dad sitting on a bench. No shirt, just his pants on, a gallon of milk, and, like, a scarf. And he's just like this. He's like, Justin! And he comes out. He goes, ah! And he comes, you know, happy drunk, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you wise ass. He'd always say this little wise ass thing to me. And my sister-in-law literally goes, who's that? And my wife was like, that's Justin's father. Like, it was, I mean, he was that guy that you would see just out. I mean, he lived in the pay toilet at the parking garage. You probably parked in that garage.
Oh, my God.
When you went to, he lived in the pay toilet.
When I played the speakeasy?
No, that's the other end of town.
When I did the
Portsmouth Music Hall. It's right around the corner from the Portsmouth Music Hall.
He lived in the garage.
He lived in the pay toilet of that
But, I mean,
garage.
How does, is there some element of heartbreak to all of it? I guess he was a town drunk and he was a happy drunk and he was a character, but, I mean, it must have been sad as hell for, you know. Or do you just get over that and you just sort of accept it?
Look, I mean, I've gone to see therapists, you know, in 2010 or 11, I went to see the first one. I mean, there's definitely stuff underneath with what's gone on in my life that I know is there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's why I became a comedian, right? It's humor. We deal with it with humor. We laugh at it.
When did you decide to do that?
I had been a cop for a few years, and it was just something I just wanted to try.
Now, what happened to your aunt?
She's still around.
Oh.
But they just kind of, you know, they broke it off.
Did she get sober?
She's older now. So it's like, I don't think she's drinking anymore. Now that you mention that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think she's drinking anymore either.
Is the family still close to some degree?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're close. They don't talk.
They
don't talk. But like, I just saw her and probably talked to her for 5 minutes, which is the most I've talked to her in about 5 years, actually, just a couple weeks ago.
But everyone's, you know, like, your old man's got a relationship with your kids and your brother's kids.
Yeah, my dad now is like, I mean, you know, my kids who are now 9 and 11 years old don't know him any different.
Yeah.
He shows up every birthday with balloons. When my dad was first in rehab for the first time, he had an index card. And he said to me, I went and visited him at rehab, and he wanted to know my date of birth and my phone number.
Yeah.
And he had me and all my brothers, and he wrote it all in an index card. Like, I mean, you talk about the birthday.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, because he didn't even, and in my dad, in this funny way, people will ask, oh, how old are your kids now? And he'll say, it's hard to keep track. It changes every year. You know what I mean? That's his line, you know? So now my kids, he shows up, and he's got the balloons, and he used to be a black belt in karate, my dad.
Really?
Yeah, so he teaches, he teaches my kids now karate lessons. He'll come over and
No kidding. How old is he?
He's 77 now.
Wow.
Yeah. Good shape. He walks every day. He'll credit the fact that he walks. He's always walked. Even when he was drunk, he was walking.
Well, he's homeless.
Walking. He was homeless. What else he gonna do? But he made sure he got his walk in. And he, you know, one night he was hit by a, he was going to the bathroom on the side of the road. He was hit by a snowplow.
What?
Like that, he ended up in the hospital. Like, yeah, that was, part of what got him sober was he almost died. He punctured a lung.
He got hit by a snowplow.
Yeah, he got hit by a snowplow. He was actually, and I'm not making this up, he was going to, he was taking a dump on the side of the road, and a snowplow came and knocked him over an embankment. And I, what? No, I, and
can't take it.
He even says, no, he didn't actually get hurt. That time he didn't get hurt that bad because I said to him, I go, you all right? He goes, yeah, I was wearing my puffy coat or something, he said.
Right.
But he got hit by another, and hit a guardrail, punctured. He was walking around with a punctured lung for like a day and a half. And the doctor said, if you didn't get in here today, you'd be dead. And so that was the first time, I think. And, you know, and yeah, we thought he was going to die. It's amazing.
Do you think that you're being a cop and you're trying to resolve this? I mean, obviously, it's antithetical. It's like it is literally the opposite of your father, right? I mean, he didn't look at you as the enemy, but he had a relationship with the cops. No matter how much it almost in my mind it plays out like this comedy. That it was just the way the dynamic was, and they knew him, and he knew them, and this is the way it's going to be. You see this stuff on like cop shows, like yeah. that guy, it's this guy again. So you become this thing that completely separates you and defines you as your own person, and is completely the opposite of your father, and somehow or another that didn't quite help you process, whatever it is that you were trying to process. And then at some point you decide, well, comedy, is it possible? Do you ever think of it in those terms?
Well, I got to tell you, I could remember, and I don't know if I've ever said this or if my dad remembers. I could remember my dad watching The Tonight Show one night when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I remember him making a comment as to, I could have done this or something like that. I could have done this.
Right.
And I remember it being like, be in show business. Like, be like, I think
he's a funny guy.
Carson was doing his monologue, I think. And I think that's, and I don't know if he remembers that, but I always remembered that. And here I am thinking, well, you might have, but look at, you're drinking. Like, you know what I mean? Whatever you, and there was always a side of me that, back in junior high was the first time I thought I might want to be a stand up someday. Yeah. I just didn't know how to do it.
Right.
It's just, how do you make a living doing that? But I remember that's the first time I had the thought.
Who'd you like what was it that made you think that?
Well, Carlin and Eddie Murphy were like the big ones. That was a little older, more like in high school,
right?
Like Rodney Dangerfield, but I could just remember thinking funny things. Like if I would hear something on the monologue, I remember thinking, oh, I had that thought,
right?
Like that's when I thought I had a mind for it,
right?
So
how do you quit being a cop?
While I was still a cop, I went down and did Stitches one night, did an open mic.
Time.
And I drove down and just tried it. And then, and then I just went back, tried it again. And
Were your jokes about being a cop?
They weren't at that point. First time I went down, I didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
I just me. I didn't want, if I, bombed.
Right.
I didn't want, that might have been it.
Yeah.
But it actually went surprisingly well. So when I went back, I signed up again to do it like 4, 5, 6 months
Who was
later.
Hosting? You remember who was hosting?
I think it was Vinny Favorito.
Oof.
Yeah, Vinny Favorito.
Yeah.
And so the second time I went back, I told everybody because I thought it went pretty well.
He was probably nervous you were a cop.
I don't know if he knew. I don't know if he knew.
Oh.
So, but he should have been, right?
Is he still around?
He's back in the Boston area.
Yeah.
Yeah, back in the Boston area.
Huh.
So the second time I go back, I tell if like 40 people come down. They come down and try, right? I went up. I had the suit coat on. I'll never forget. I had a sport coat on, and I left the tag on because I was going to try to work it into my act.
Yeah.
I left the price taggy thing, that thing you're supposed to take off on. So I get up there. I start in, and it's not going well.
Right.
So I start dropping F-bombs. Like every fifth word is an F-bomb.
Yeah.
I'm sweating. I'm bombing. Okay.
Yeah.
And I know 40 people are there. I'm bombing. Okay. Vinny, it's a crutch to use the F word, right? So I'm throwing it out everywhere. Vinny comes up, grabs the mic, and he says, "Hey, Justin," he's like, "next time, why don't you try throwing a few fucks in there? Maybe that'll get them," right? Oh, huge laugh, right? And I hadn't even, I'm still on stage, and he goes, "What's with the?" He points out my little tag on the coat. He goes, "What's with the coat there?" Right? So I try to like spin it. He's got a Giggles jacket on. Remember they had the Giggles, the Knicks jackets, the Giggles jacket.
Yeah.
And I go, "Oh, what's this coat? Giggles?" And he just goes, "Yeah, it's a place where I get paid to tell jokes."
Ooh.
Another big laugh. I walked off. That was it. That was my second time. And I almost, Mark, felt I can't go out like that. And I think that's what motivated me to go back. Oh, so here I am in the back of the room, and I know other comedians have a very similar story because I've since found this. So I'm in the back of the room. A guy goes on next, who I saw the last time I was there, does the exact same jokes he did, and I was like, you can do that? I did a whole new set my second time. I didn't know that I could repeat material.
Yeah.
So I was really like, you can do that? So that was...
That's it.
Yeah, so that was it. And now that I knew that I could do that...
Yeah, work on it. Yeah.
Let me just go do the best of the first three.
Yeah.
You know, mix it with if I had anything funny in the second three. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And that's how it kind of started.
I guess that is a big moment where you realize, like, you can just work on these jokes. You're not getting paid. You know, there's nothing, you know, you're just trying to figure out how to get laughs. So that's how it starts. So when did you stop being a cop, and when did you start doing the material about being a cop?
Right around the mid-90s, I moved down to Peabody, Mass. I don't know if you know Peabody.
I do. I know someone was from Peabody.
Gary Goldman's from Peabody.
Right,
Gary Goldman. So I moved to Peabody because my uncle had a place there, and I was part-time still as a cop. I would go up and do shifts.
Uh-huh.
I would drive up. There was only about an hour and a half drive. So I stayed on as a cop in case the comedy thing didn't kind of work. I could go back without having to go to the academy again. I still had my certification.
Yeah.
So at that time, I started to work in stuff about material, about being a cop. I was getting on almost every night of the week, you know, as much as I could get on. With Nick's, and there was the Comedy Palace was around then, or a couple other ones. So I was just hammering away, and it started to feel good after about a year or so. And the move that got me to New York was... this comedian, a good friend of mine, Al Ducharme.
I know Al. I've done road gigs with Al. He was very funny.
Yeah,
I've seen him a couple of times, not too long ago.
He was very funny. Great guy.
And yeah, I did a lot of gigs with Al Ducharme.
Yeah. He's been doing it for a long time.
So
he said to me that there was a guy in New York City named Kerry Hoffman who has Stand Up New York.
Yeah.
And he's a manager, and he's looking for people. Why don't you send him a tape? So I sent him a tape, and he called me. He goes, hey, I want you to come down to New York. I want to talk about managing you.
Yeah.
So that opened up the New York door. At the same time, I started to do NACAs.
The college
stuff, right?
Yep.
So I went down to do a NACA. My college agent.
A convention.
Yeah, a NACA convention, yep.
Yeah, so if they like you, you can get a year's worth of work out of that shit, right?
Yep, you do 20 minutes, and if the colleges like you, you can get 100 schools. They can sign you up. So I had a really good set at this NACA. So it made my agent mention me to her friend at Don Buchwald down in New York, Kristen Miller, I believe is her name.
Yeah.
And so Kristen Miller reaches out to me and says, hey, I want to come out and see you in New York. Where are you working? And I go, well, I don't live in New York. I'm up in Boston. I'm not working anywhere. He goes, I'll get you a spot at the comic strip. Okay. So I go, okay. So she comes to see me at the comic strip. So Lucian was there.
Yeah.
And I had
Justin.
Yeah. Well, I didn't even know him until after I got off the stage. So I knew nothing about the place. I knew nothing about how hard it is to get on these places, how hard it is to break in. I do my set for her. And I get off stage, and Lucian tells me that if I, you know, move down there, I can start putting in for spots.
Wow.
So, but it helped because I had someone from the industry.
Yeah, get you in the spot.
Getting me the spot. So. Yeah. Then I had a meeting with Kerry Hoffman where he's like, you can start working this club, Stand Up New York, and he wanted to manage me, and I said I didn't know yet, you know, I'm still sorting things out, so I got in at that club, and then this is all before I moved down there. And
what's this, mid-90s?
Yeah, this is like 96, 97, like 97,
yeah.
Like 97 now.
So you move.
So I move, yeah.
And that was the beginning.
And I lived in Astoria, Queens, and that's where I met you for the first time.
Because I was living there?
I first met you walking down the street.
On like 30th Avenue or something?
I went one of those. We walk in one day and I met you.
Not a happy time.
That's Mark Maron. Well, it's, you know, it was, you were nice to me.
Yeah.
You know, you're friendly.
That's a good story.
You were friendly. Well, I mean, you were, you know, hey, what's, you know, but I just remember you were like one of the guys that were there and, you know, Louie and you and Dave Attell. And you guys were like New York.
Yeah.
In my mind, you guys were like the cool New York guys.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And so how does it transpire? Because, like, I guess. Like Ruth Ann, I mean, my thing with Ruth Ann, that it happened in, like, you know, I didn't get, well, I mean, I had a few deals here and there, but she was still in the racket of getting guys big deals because she got John DiResta, the other cop. She got him his big deal.
Yep. So when she wanted to come see me, now I, She wanted to come and see me. I think it was a guy named Josh Pollock. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, it was her assistant.
Okay.
He's an actual agent now. I think he still is.
Yeah. So he had seen me and said, you got to come see this guy. So she comes down to see me. And at this point, Ruth Ann's coming to see me.
Yeah.
I had all the New York managers taking me out to lunch wanting to manage me.
What, Katz?
Katz.
Hoffman.
Yes, but...
Dorfman.
Yes, but no, but also Becky.
Becky. Yeah, yeah.
Dave Becky. Rose Garden.
Rory, yeah.
All of, Bruce Hills.
Yeah, from Montreal. Was he managing people?
He was managing people.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'll never forget it because people say, hey, have you done Montreal?
Right.
And I'm like, no, I had lunch with Bruce Hills.
Right.
And I was going to be in Montreal every year for the rest of my life. And then I didn't end up going with him.
Ever?
I didn't end up going with... I've never done Montreal. I still haven't. I did Aspen and all that, but
sure.
I've never done Montreal. And I don't know if that had something to do with it or not, but I didn't...
You can still get in there.
Yeah, I know, but I haven't tried in years.
Right.
But so what Ruth Ann told me was, why do you want a manager? Like, why do you want to just get... I'm going to get you a deal. You want to give away 10, 15% for nothing?
Right.
And at the time, sounded pretty good. I'm like, yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah.
Why do I need a manager? In hindsight, I wish I would have gone with a manager because then once the deals don't happen, they fall through. You go back to the managers. Hey, remember you liked me 3 years ago? You know what I mean?
So what happened? So like what? You go and you listen to Ruth Ann and she gets you what? A deal?
Mm-hmm. Yep, with I was meeting with a bunch. It's like a bidding war.
Oh, big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was meeting with CBS, Warner Brothers. It ended up coming to Overbrook, Will Smith's company. I think those were the three that were...
It was a cop show?
Yeah, it was about me back where I used to work. It was just about my life.
The Dark Mayberry show.
It wasn't dark, though.
Oh.
Because it wasn't really dark. This guy, Ephraim Seeger, ended up... I picked showrunners. I met with all the showrunners.
Yep.
Co-wrote it with them.
Right.
Wrote the pilot.
Yep.
We ended up going with Warner Brothers, the studio.
Uh-huh.
And you know, there's a lot of those politics where apparently, from what I had heard, the head of... Warner Brothers just got a new head of... the guy became the head of Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
A different guy. And Les at CBS, they don't get along. And from what I heard, the last thing they want to do is make one of his shows. You know, this guy comes into the Warner Brothers, we're going to make one of his shows right away. So there was a little bit of a political thing.
So you got the deal with Warner Brothers, and then all of a sudden they change guards, and Moonves doesn't want to have anything to do with that guy. So you got stuck. It's always something.
That was a rumor. It's always something. Yeah. So nothing happened.
Well, but it didn't end well for Moonves, so, you know.
No, I know. Where's that guy now? No.
I'm sure
I met him.
Fine,
yeah,
somewhere.
I'm sure he's got money.
Yeah. But, all right, so the first deal goes nowhere. You shoot a pilot? What?
We didn't shoot the pilot, only wrote the pilot.
Yeah, I've been there twice, three times. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, okay, so you got no manager, but you got like $500,000 in the bank. More.
No. It was 370, first one.
Okay. Well, I wasn't looking for numbers, but it's a lot of money for doing nothing.
But the reason I'm going to tell you, because I know a lot of people at the time were probably like, oh, this guy getting the deals, you know, a little jealous or bitter or whatever, upset with
Usually me. It was a 200, 250 deal.
But
it was what you got for those development deals if you weren't a hot property.
Well, I ended up losing it all. So that's why I don't mind having the number, because it has a sad ending.
But wait, so you out here, you get the deal, and you stay out here after the shit goes south, and what do you do? You're doing stand-up?
I was still in New York.
I never moved out here.
To L.A. I hadn't moved to L.A. yet. The first deal goes nowhere. That's when Ruth Ann gets the idea. Pair me up with John DiResta.
Oh, so
that's the second deal.
Now, had his show gone south yet? Or this is his first shot?
He had a show on UPN that went south, yes.
So he was going to be the new Gleason, and that didn't...
Yes.
It didn't happen.
It didn't, yeah, UPN.
A lot of billboards.
Yep.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff.
They must have shot a few. What, they do 12 or something?
Oh, I think he might have got a season.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
20 episodes. So now he's down and out. You're both Ruth Ann clients. You're both cops. So, of course, Ruth Ann. You know where the thing is, Ruth Ann, I ran into her recently. I was at WME, and she came to see me do something. She had been at... ICM, and it was weird because she, you know, we went out to lunch and I knew it had to be about something. We caught up, but I really hadn't seen her. I didn't know what she was up to. And she talked me into, you know, going with ICM. And I was at WME, but I was a little, you know, I wasn't happy. And that was what she talked me into going with ICM, which I did. I'm with one of the big guys over there. And then she quit.
Oh, well, she's not doing it anymore?
I don't know what she's doing. I think she went into the other side, development. I don't know.
Wow.
But I was the last thing she did. She She pulls me away. She got me twice. Fucking Ruth Ann. 30 years apart.
I mean, I'm very fond of her. I have such fond memories because she changed my life at that time.
No.
She believed in me, and she like did, and she was going to bat for me. And
she changed everyone's life.
But was one thing that she did, too, that I wish she hadn't done.
What?
Which would be the third year. We'll get to that if you want me to go back to the second year with DeRester.
Well, yeah, what happened with DeRester? That? So
John and I,
yeah.
Now we have this show. I moved down from Maine to become a cop. I'm the, you know the kind of cop I am. I'm the good cop. I want to change the world. I want to change everyone's opinion of law enforcement, you know, one person at a time.
Yeah.
John is the bitter, you know, doesn't even want the job, wants to get hurt on the job so he can collect pension, get out of it, doesn't want to eat in public, doesn't want the public to see him. It's an odd couple, right?
He's not an immoral cop. He's just a guy that
he's
wants out.
He's not immoral. He wants out. Yeah, he wants out. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So we have to pick a showrunner, and we ended up picking Alan Kirshenbaum.
Oh, yeah, I know Alan.
Yeah, Alan.
He did that Anthony Clark show. He passed away.
He did.
Who was his dad? He was Freddie Roman's son. Right. He killed Roman's himself, son. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
A nice guy,
and we write it. We pick Alan. We all write it together, the three of us. Co-write it.
Yeah.
And CBS says, you know, the people at, because this deal was right with CBS, the quote, I'll never forget it, because you don't forget these things. They're like, you know, this is our favorite show this year. We just want to let you know this is our favorite show. Yeah. And I didn't get that the first year.
Sure.
Like, I never heard that. We just want to, you know, this. So I'm thinking, article in Variety.
On paper.
This could be it. Yeah.
You hadn't shot anything yet.
Hadn't shot anything yet.
Right.
Okay. So we're just waiting for Les to read it. You know what I mean? Because I haven't got the Les yet.
Yeah.
In the trades, we see that Alan Kirshenbaum sells a show to CBS called Yes, Dear. It was the same year. Same year that he was doing it. We didn't know he was doing another show with CBS at the time. John and I were both like, that's probably not good.
Yeah.
That's probably not good. So we get a call, you know, hey, yeah, you know, the show I'm doing, but you know what? If anything happens with this show, if it doesn't make it, doesn't cast, we want to make yours. They held us longer. They held us a little bit longer just in case to give them time to see what happens with Yes, Dear. This is how close this one got to getting made. Long story short, Yes, Dear stays on. Rest is history. Our show, nothing ever happens with our show.
Show business is the worst.
So, but I got a story that you mentioned Alan Kirshenbaum.
Yeah.
So that pilot called The Finest sat in my brother's, I was in LA, so my brother had boxes for me that he was keeping in his old house.
Yeah.
He calls me up. This is in 2012. He says, hey, I got some old boxes here. He says, do you want to come over and get rid of this stuff? You know, because I'm selling the house or whatever. So he drops the boxes off. I open up the box, and right there's the pilot, The Finest, that we wrote, right?
With Kirshenbaum.
I read it. I'm just sitting there in my driveway.
Yeah.
Just reading it. And I'm like, man, that's a pretty good, it still holds up. It's a pretty good show, right? It's just, you know, I put it down the next day. John DeRester, I haven't talked to in 5 years. I have not talked to John in 5 years before this. Calls me up and goes, did you hear Alan Kirshenbaum just killed himself?
Yeah.
It was the next day. I hadn't thought or seen that pilot in 12 years, I just read it.
Yeah.
And that it was so free. But yeah, so sad.
Weird.
So sad. And he was 51.
I know.
So.
I don't know what happened there. I don't know. He was 51 and he had, you know, all the money in the world.
I know. That just goes to show. So.
So you're two down.
I'm two down.
Ugh. Now, but you made money on that second one too.
Yep.
So you saved some money.
I had some money.
Are you
in the
married
bank.
At the point yet?
Nope.
Yeah.
But still with my girlfriend who's my now wife.
Right.
She's my wife. So. I'm at Dangerfields.
So you never went to LA. You're still in New York. You're at Dangerfields.
I'm still in New York. I'm in Dangerfields. There's a guy there that's a waiter.
Yeah.
It's a part-time stockbroker.
Yeah.
1999.
Yeah.
Okay? Tells me, he goes, hey, man, I do this on the side. Stock market's going nuts. If you remember 99, if you were in it or at all. Stock market's going nuts. He goes,
I didn't have any money in
there. Give me some. You know what? I wish I didn't. Because this is where the story goes from. The best thing that happened to me with those deals, and it was the worst. And in hindsight, I wish I never got the deals.
Right.
So I see this guy. I give him 10 grand.
Mm.
He doubles it in like 2 weeks, right? Then I give him 50 grand. He doubles that.
Yeah.
I give him more. He doubles that.
Yeah.
He's like, on paper, Mark, I am like, I'll never forget the quote. He said to me, he goes, I'm going to have you at $1 million by the end of the year.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going to have $1 million by the end, right?
This is the waiter.
This is the waiter. Cut to the market crashes, right? The big crash of 2000? It was 2000. Big crash of 2000. I didn't realize that I had kept like 100 grand in cash.
Yeah.
$100,000 was in mutual funds, but didn't realize those were in tech funds.
Right.
So that was all gone. I didn't realize that when you sell a stock in less than a year, you have to pay the government capital gains on that, 50%. So all that, every time he was doubling my money, taking out double, I owed the IRS.
Yeah.
So I had to take all the money I had, the $100,000 that was my safety net. Let's be smart. Let's not do anything stupid. I had to give all that to the government. So I ended up with $10,000 after all of that. And I couldn't even look at it. I was in such depression. And when I tell you, I bought a leather jacket, and I'm not lying, I bought a leather jacket, and I was just looking to buy a new car. I had a Honda Civic.
Yeah.
Tree fell on it. So I had a big dent in the front, and I pulled into the shopping center. And what was the supermarket in Astoria, Queens, off the main drag there? What was that called? Vaughn's? No.
No.
That's L.A.
No. What was
Pathmark.
It? Yeah, Pathmark.
Pathmark.
That sounds right.
I pull into Pathmark. I don't know. I think they're Mexican or Hispanic. I don't know what nation, but they come up to me and they're like, "Do I fix your car? Fix your car?" And I go, "I don't." They stuck a drill right into the side of my car, and they just right there. They had the putty and everything, and they just stuck a drill in it. And they popped
pulling
it
out. Yeah,
I didn't even. They painted it, and I sprayed it. It didn't even match or anything. Yeah. I threw them a few bucks, and then I'm like, "I gotta get a new car." And but it was like right when it crashed, so I stayed. I kept that car for another 2 years. I had my leather jacket. That was it, and I had $10,000 that literally went into like a retirement thing, and that's still. That $10,000 I still have.
But yeah, what did you, I mean, what's the lesson there? Maybe you know, look, stockbrokers are dubious, but the waiter stockbroker, maybe not the best idea.
Mark, yeah. I'm embarrassed to tell the story. So this guy, who I hadn't heard from in a few years, all of a sudden out of the blue, calls me up. He goes, "Hey," I'm going to say his first name, I'm going to say his last name. He goes, "Hey, Dan here." I'm like, "Hey, what's up, Dan?" And I'm in like deep depression. He's like, "Got a lot of big things happening. I got some stuff I want to tell you about." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "There's some companies I really think are going to move." I'm like, "Dan, I have no money."
Yeah.
I go, "I've been wiped out." He goes, "You know," he goes, "that was a tough stretch for a lot of people." He goes, I moved back in with my grandmother. I swear to God. He goes, I'm living with my grandmother now. And I'm like, so, and he called and showed up a couple times. And I'm like, and I would joke, you know, I said this as a joke. I said, he went from being my stockbroker to my broke stalker.
Yeah.
Like he just kept showing, I'm like, "What are you, I go, "I got nothing left." I go, "This guy, meeting him, like ruined my, you know, I didn't buy property." I lived in a 2.5 family in Astoria, Queens, the one that I could have bought that. Like I could have bought that for cash. It's worth like 1.5 million now. So just if I would have bought property, but I didn't.
Yeah.
So when you talk about, I got this windfall. I was lucky to get it. But when my accountant says there's people jumping out of buildings that didn't have as bad of a case as you have of losing money like that. I still to this day write off, I think $3,000 every year off my losses for the rest of my life.
For that?
Yeah. It's like I wish my development deal was, you know what? We can't give you much money, but every year you can write $3,000 off your taxes for life. I would have been like, sign me up.
So that's pretty brutal, man. And I mean, are you doing comedy through all this?
I am, but it was tough. It was a depressing, you know, I got Jay Leno, and I did Leno for the first time in 2002, which was my goal when I had set out. If I could do The Tonight Show, that was the one thing. My dad, you know, we used to watch it.
Yeah.
If I could do The Tonight Show, I was so depressed when I did it. Like, I can't
even
watch
me.
It was. I thought it was okay. They had me back, so it was good, but it wasn't good. I wasn't myself.
Right.
I watched myself. I was like, there was this gloom, doom and gloom underneath me when I watch it. Like, I could see it. And here, this should have been the happiest moment of my life. And I like, and it just literally, I just wasn't even myself. I'm like, who is that guy? I would love to do that material again. No, it was a tough, I moved to LA in 2001.
That's when you came?
Yes, 2001 I came, after I had lost. Exactly, so I'm walking around in LA.
Oh my God.
Having lost,
God.
So, and that's the sun was out and I was not.
That's not the time to come.
No.
You come when you get the deal and then you kind of, you know, delude yourself and think it's all turned around, but you lost everything and you're like, I'm gonna go there?
Yes. I know.
That's like the most depressing situation I can imagine.
Yeah.
So you're here, you're broke, you're just doing a Tonight Show, you've had three deals, you're well-trodden territory, and what are you doing?
Well, I had two deals. The third one was one I was going to tell about Ruth Ann. Will Smith's company offered me a deal. This was in 2000. This was in 2000. That's part of why I gave the guy almost all my money, because I knew I had another one coming from Will Smith's company.
Right.
The last minute, she says, "You know what? I don't think we should take it. It's $250,000.
Yeah.
She goes, "I don't think we should take it." I'm like, "Really? Yeah, they haven't had a show on yet. They haven't gotten a show on the air. I think it's a bad year. Let's wait a year." That I'll never, but so I never got that one. So that was there. I never took it because I was thinking, all right, let me get this. I'll buy a house with that money.
Yeah.
I'll have this money in the stock market.
Yeah.
So that never happened.
Everything was going your way, man.
So in 2000, 2001 now,
Turn
when I moved
down.
There, 9/11, 2001.
When you moved to L.A.?
Yes, I moved to L.A. in January of 2001.
And then 9/11.
And then it changed. Well, it just changed the... I had put up my one-man show at the HBO Workspace. Do you remember that?
Sure, I did one-man shows there. I've had desperate attempts at... please, help me. Yeah, I should have called all my shows there. I think I did two one-man shows there. Subtitled, please help me. Yeah.
Oh.
So what happened? So
I put that up. I think it was September 17th, 2001. It was a week after 9/11.
That's right. My book came out around 9/11. My first book. Yeah, it was not a good. It's a sad day for everybody.
It was a sad day, and I mean, it was weird. I got Aspen that year. I took the one man show. That was the year in Aspen. Nobody's buying, but reality TV had just come, right?
Yeah.
Survivor, Big Brother. So that was the
fear factor.
The change. Fear, all of that.
Yeah.
So it just changed. So now by 02, your writing's on the wall. No money. I blew it. I was all set up to do what I came to do. I was a gift, and
yeah.
I blew it. So that's what I had to live with. For years.
Yeah, don't think that, but you don't really feel like you blew it. I mean, the show business part, you didn't blow. That's just the nature of show business. I mean, you know, giving a waiter 200 grand, not a great idea. But I mean, but show business is show business.
Mark. giving a waiter 200 grand was not smart. I had a trademark.
Yeah.
Do you know Lucky Brand Dungarees?
Yeah.
I had the trademark Lucky Anywhere, and I sold it to Lucky Brand Dungarees for $4,000.
Lucky Anywhere?
Lucky Anywhere. It was just a trademark I had. They bought it from me.
What made you register?
I was going to do clothes. I had this clothing line.
When was this?
This was in mid to late 90s. Same time I was doing stand-up at a clothing line. I bought the trademark to Suck It Up. It was like a sports line.
Yeah.
Bill Parcells wore it. Kurt Schilling with a bloody sock, like had my hat on before he pitched with the bloody sock.
Did you make money at that?
No, I didn't make money because I'm a horrible businessman, obviously.
Yeah.
That's the waiter doing my stock stuff. And the $4,000 that Lucky gave me for that trademark, I found out later from a patent attorney, he goes, you only got $4,000? He's like, who handled that case? My buddy was a defense attorney.
Was he a waiter?
No, he was more. He was a defense attorney. He just tried to keep me out of jail. I'm like, you know, he does OUIs, you know, DWI.
Yeah.
And he handled that. So that, like, literally, so that's, when you talk about bad decisions, I've got.
Why were you going to go to jail?
No, I'm just saying as a defense attorney.
Right.
He's worried. He just is trying
wasn't
to get
his
people
area.
Off. He wasn't his area. And, you know, having a waiter do my stocks and a defense attorney handle my patent trademark thing. So I've got, you know what I mean? So those mistakes, that's what haunts me a little bit.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
But wait. Tell me about the day you decided to leave L.A.
Oh.
What? Were you working out here? Right, because you're on the Tonight Show. You do the improv.
I was doing. I passed, you know, the Funny Bone and the Improvs to headline. I was headlining all those all over the country.
Oh, that's
so
good.
So
you're working.
I went and did the audition, but it was the thing where now I've got to go out of town all the time.
You got no other. You are a road comic.
I'm a road comic to try to make money now. To buy a house.
Do you have kids yet? No.
No kids. So the real estate market here is going up. I'm trying to make the money so I could get a down payment on a house. By around 2005, I had done the Leno in 04 again. I went back in 04. So by 05, we go look at places. It's two bedrooms are $500,000.
Here.
Right? Here.
Yeah.
My wife doesn't like it here.
Yeah.
She's kind of miserable.
I what mean, does she do?
She was working at a staffing agency up in the valley, like in Woodland Hills.
Yeah.
And she just wanted to be back home. You know, we got married in 04.
Mm-hmm.
So in 04, at the wedding, I saw the writing. All the friends like, when are you guys coming back? We can't wait till you come back. When are you, you know, that everyone was saying that. And I'm like, uh-oh, this isn't going to be good.
When's because Justin going to grow back. Up?
Yeah. When's he going to give up? Right. When's he going to give up on this comedy
That's funny,
thing?
The fine line between grow up and give up. That's a funny. I never really thought of that.
Yeah.
When did you get to grow up? When did we even give up? Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. When did you give up? I mean, grow up.
So by this time it was like 05, 06. We were looking at property. It was so expensive here that we finally, went back in 06 and bought a house. And you know what the irony, the sad, sick irony was?
Another sad, sick irony.
Oh, yes. The I know it's horrible. The house I bought in New Hampshire. was the same price that I could have bought the one I lived in Astoria, Queens.
Yeah, but you got to let it was that shit
I know. I'm awful. I didn't go to therapist until I was in 2010, 11. I'm actually doing better now, Mark, than I was just even 2 months ago.
But were you just a... yeah?
I am.
But were you just a cauldron of resentment and self-pity? Or
yeah. Yeah,
so your wife wants to go back. You know, you realize you can't talk her out of it with anything on paper. There's no, you say like, I guess I can do the road gigs from there. Doesn't matter where I am because I'm on the road all the time, right?
That was her defense. Sure. It's like, if you're going to be gone all the time, I want to be there. And it kind of made sense. But in my mind, I'm thinking, well, then I'm
out of the
never,
game.
I'm out of the game.
Yeah.
So I moved back in 06. And I got to tell you, the first 3 or 4 years were good. And the fact I had a lot of stuff that I parlayed. I got a half-hour Comedy Central special while living there.
Right.
I got a 1 hour.
Right.
I did the Blue Collar Tour, Next Gen. I was chosen for that. And I had a deal with Comedy Central.
Who else was on that?
That was Bill Engvall hosted it.
Yeah.
And then it was Reno Collier.
Yeah.
John Caparulo.
Yeah.
Jamie Kaler and myself.
What's Caparulo up to? I used to see him all the time.
I was just in Vegas, and he was he's got a residency there, I guess.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, and I did a Showtime special with him, with Rob Gronkowski, that's that like a year and a half ago. He was on that. He was picked to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, so I just saw him.
Oh, so he's out there doing it.
A year and a half ago, yeah.
You never know what guys are up to, but there's so much to do. All right, so you get that, so it's a good few years, and you're living in New Hampshire, you have a kid?
Yeah, first kid in 07. Right away, we got back, 06, 07, first
Your
kid.
Your dad got sober, things are different there?
Hadn't been sober yet, because that was 07, so it's been, just shortly after that, yep, like 09 or something.
So, that's good.
Yeah, so I got the wife, got the kids. I had a few, I shot a show, about a volunteer fire department that Dennis Leary Apostle saw.
Serpico,
the same time
you did
Marin
my show,
was on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the same time that was on, we sold this one to IFC.
Uh-huh.
So that was all done from New Hampshire. So, part of what I'm trying to do is stay in the game and stay relevant back there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, the last few years I've been out here pitching with different people and trying to sell shows. I mean, I've got something now that I'm working on. So trying to stay relevant out here has been the challenge. But that, it didn't end up getting picked up, but it's like I wrote that pilot. So I've had some stuff happen, but as every year goes by, it feels like you're further and further away. That's why, I'm getting old, and that's why,
we all are.
Dude, to do your podcast is great for me. I'm being completely honest. It's relevant. Because I'm looking at I'm like, if I was out here, I'd be doing these podcasts. And I'd be,
Everybody's scrambling, dude.
Everyone's scrambling, yeah.
But, you're still doing a lot of comedy. You still do all right up there? You turn over an hour every year? What's your process?
Yeah, that's the process that stresses me out. The whole, in order to make decent money, you got to do the theaters.
Right.
And in order to do the theaters, you got to turn over the material. You can't do the same stuff. This that whole thing.
Right.
Someone will come see you twice, but if it's the same stuff, they're not going to see you a third time.
Right.
So that's been the battle. So the battle is there's not places to get on and work during the week. There's no scene. I got an open mic I do every Tuesday. I try to do 7-8 minutes, hope that two or three of those minutes make it into the weekend.
Sure.
And then I just try to build my year that way.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel sustainable.
Right.
It does not feel sustainable. And I just did the Rochester Opera House a few months ago, and show couldn't have gone better from my end. And after it, I looked bummed out, I guess. And the guy opens for me, my good friend Jeff, was like, "It's like, what's wrong, man? You look bummed out." And I said to him, I go, "What am I going to do next year?"
Yeah.
Like, I finally got this stuff to where it needed to be, where it was all working. And now it's like, I can't do, I come up with a new closer. I mean, it's, the work that goes into it.
No, I know.
It.
But
so it's just,
why? Just because of that one gig, or you just played it out? Can't you tour it?
I do these same theaters every year, same time of year.
Yeah.
So as I do one, now I'm already building for the next time I come back around in next March and do that venue again. I'm hoping to have, and it's not all new. You know what? I'm starting to do something now where I'm going to start doing old stuff like at the end, just because I can't do it. I can't.
Yeah, you need about a year and a half, really. And you can't turn it over in less than a year. It's hard.
And you feel bad. People come out and it's not ready.
It's the worst
feeling.
It's
not ready. It's half baked. And so
I hate that feeling.
Yeah. So it's just so that's kind of the struggle, and what stresses me out now is I can't sustain this. What am I going to do? So that's it.
Yeah. But you're okay. Family's good.
kids are like, kids and wife, and it's like the family's
great. She working?
She works.
Yeah.
She has to work. I mean, that's, you know.
But it's okay.
Health insurance. Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, she'd like to not work, but so would I.
It's nice up there, though, right?
Yeah, it's nice, and it's a great place to have a family.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's once my kids were born, I even stopped doing Vegas because it was the seven nights. I don't really do... I'm home 90% of the time now. I'm trying not to do so many Wednesday to Sundays because you leave on the Wednesday, you're back on the Monday. My kids are at that age where it's...
You don't want to miss it.
I don't want to miss
it. But that's where you can generate the new shit, though.
Yep, that's the problem.
Right.
So that's the battle. It's like you're on, you miss this. Every week there's something at school you miss. Oh, it's a play. It's a, you know, it's a this.
Got to make your choice.
Yeah, it's a this presentation or the science fair or we're going to see, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's just.
But like you're saying about all these guys, you know, like, because I recently talked to Bill Janowitz from Buffalo Tom, the band. And I don't like, you know, I've sort of like changed my thinking on that. I don't know what my skill set really is. And I sort of, you know, lucked out with some persistence and good cosmic timing. But it seems like. You know, if you can live with it, there is a way to find another life, you know, that to either supplement or do, you know what I mean? Have you thought about applying your skill set to something else alongside of the comedy? Or is that just too much of a fucking ego buster?
It is a little bit. Yeah. I mean, there is some of that, right? It's like, what do we want to do? Like even selling merch, like I sold onesies like years ago, a couple weeks. I'm like, what am I doing? Like, I can't do it. I don't want to stand there.
I used to. Just boxes of shit.
Yeah,
you're traveling with three boxes of shirts and stickers.
It's but that's
right after the last set. You run out there. Hey.
And then they feel awkward if they don't buy and they walk by you. But that's when you say supplemental income, that could make a difference. That's
You, like, you know what the best thing is? Posters are good because they're easy. They're easy to travel with. You sign them, $20.
Afraid nobody would want one. Just standing there.
Yeah.
poster, anybody?
Yeah.
But so have I thought of anything else? I've thought of doing things in the speaking realm.
Right.
That realm a little bit, you know? So who knows if that'll happen.
Yeah, I mean, because it seems like, I mean, I tried to do some of that. Yeah, I don't know if I'm the best candidate for it, but, you know, speak about, like, you know, how, you know, my journey. You know, but it's hard to be, it's hard to, you know, on both sides of it where, you know, I'm going to go up and tell them, you know, some sort of success story, but it was not planned, man. It was not going, you know, I can't give you an A plus B equals your success.
No.
It's a fucking crapshoot.
Right.
It's a shitty business. And, you know, who the fuck knows what's going to happen?
In the back of your head, that's what you're thinking. You almost feel like
I'll say it.
Yeah.
Say it. It's like, you know, you guys can.
That's a great message.
Yeah, everyone can do podcasts, but, you know, don't bank on it. Good luck. Thank you.
Yeah. Right. What am I going to say? Yeah. You feel like a little bit like a fraud, right? It's not from
I won't do it, which is why I'm not getting the speaking engagements. I can't do the fraud thing that well. I try to be honest about
it. Well, with me, I was doing a drug and alcohol and motivational thing. And part of while I'm doing that, I'm like, I blew it. Like, I blew my, you know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like I should be here. You know, that was a little bit what I had.
Really?
Going on.
Yeah.
The underneath of it.
So you're working. You're solvent.
I am.
You're above water. Yeah. Your dad's sober. You got a good relationship with your family, your wife. Yeah, but you're still, something's still stuck in there, huh?
I was about to say, you know what, Mark? I never looked at it that way.
You should be grateful, fuck.
I'm better. I'm better today than I was. I started, and I know you've talked about this, a meditation.
Uh-huh, yeah.
On your podcast.
Yeah,
before.
I haven't done it. Have you done it? You do it?
Not only have I done it, I can't recommend it more. And I think you were talking with Letterman.
Yeah.
And you were asking whether you should do it. For me, where I wasn't sleeping. Every hour on the hour, I was waking up. I'm stressed, the anxiety.
Beating the shit out of yourself?
Beating the shit out of myself. It's the stress. Like all this stuff I'm telling you, got to come up with this. I can't do it. I can't sustain it. I can't come up. All of this stuff was just really killing me. And I bumped into my buddy, this Boston comedian, Dan Carone. I don't know if you know
him. I know him. Yeah, he opened for me.
Oh, Dan Carone. He's great.
Good guy.
Great
guy.
So he saw me one day at night, and I think I looked like I had been hit by a truck or beat up. I hadn't slept. I told him, and he said to me, he goes, you got to try TM. And I go, and I've heard of it because Stern had talked about it for years. And I'm like, oh, the meditation, transcendental meditation.
Yeah.
He goes, he goes, changed my life.
Huh.
He goes, it's $960. He goes, I would have paid 10 times the money. So
wow.
For someone you know to say, you would pay 10 times the money. He goes, I did it for insomnia. It's helped my sleeping creatively. So I went and did it just not even 6 weeks ago. 6 weeks ago, I went and did it.
I
did the course 4 days in a row, 90 minutes a day over 4 days.
Yeah.
And I do it 20 minutes right when I wake up, 20 minutes in the afternoon. Mark. I haven't needed a nap. I just, what it does is your brain gets in this rest state of rest where it does not get when you're sleeping. Because your brain, when you're sleeping, is all firing on all cylinders. So when you learn how to just shut it down completely, it's like charging your battery. It's like a recharge. So my energy, my mood, like everything, people, friends, family, my wife, all have noticed a difference in me.
Well,
just
I
started doing this. So I for me, it just was the right thing. And look, you don't get anything for it if you tell someone. It's not like, hey, to mention my name, they'll throw me $100.
Too bad.
Right?
You're selling me.
Well, I'm telling you, for me, it's just, I won't live
without
it.
There's a lot of way to go with it. You don't have to do TM, but like there's a lot of ways to approach meditation, but it's just getting into that place.
The thing that TM is, which I didn't understand, it's nothing to do with your breathing.
Right.
Every app I have is breathing. Uh-huh. I've been meditating for years with the breathing.
Oh, really?
TM, you don't...
He says angrily, the fucking breathing. Enough with the breathing.
It's not working. I know the breathing. It's done nothing for me, Mark. So what this is you it's your mind. You think of this mantra in your mind, and your breathing almost stops. You know, everything in your body metabolically goes way, 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 way down, and eventually the mantra disappears, and you have nothing, and then a thought comes up. That's stress getting released. And that's the thought. And now you come back up to the circle, top of the circle with the mantra. You go back and you just keep doing that. And you get better and better at getting to the spot where you're like, oh my God, this is it. It feels amazing.
So where the thoughts don't come.
There's no thought and there's no mantra. And your just brain is just shut down. And you think it is so hard to do. You think, oh, I can just shut my brain off. You can't do it.
No, I know. Well, fortunately for me, as I get older, I'm forgetting almost everything. So I hope it's not Alzheimer's, but like it's a little easier to quiet my brain down because it doesn't seem to give a shit about a lot of this stuff that I used to. What are you doing in town? Did you do anything but this?
I actually was on my way out here for this other meeting, this other show. I'm trying to, and it actually fell apart. It's turned into
today?
A conference call. Yeah, it's turned into a conference call now. So
you flew out for a meeting, and now it's a conference.
Yeah,
God damn, I don't fucking miss that thing. Well, flying, like when you come in from New York for auditions
know,
and shit.
I know. It's kind of, but I'm happy to do it. Trust me.
Yeah, but did you meditate?
Oh, I meditated. That's just it. See, I'm a different person, Mark. If I did this 2 months ago, I would be like, oh, it sucks.
Well, it's good to see you.
Thank you
and
so much.
I'm glad that mentally you're doing okay. You're doing better. I'm happy that your dad's sober. That's a hell of a story.
Yeah, it is. I always thought, Mark, that you always think you want your parents to be proud of you, but I think what I really wanted was to be proud of my dad.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's what I've realized like in life, and it's like I couldn't be prouder of him. So,
oh man, that's great.
Got a happy ending.
All right, thanks, man.
Thanks, Mark.
Wild story, right? Right? I remember when, like, those outros coming out of an interview where I'm clearly back where we started, that I was so worried about the transition, and I wanted to fool you guys like it was seamless, like the guy just left, and at some point I'm like, that doesn't matter. Justin McKinney, the new special, Parentally Challenged, on Amazon Prime, iTunes. You can go to justinmckinney.com. Great story, though, right? You know what this is? That's the sound of my mustache coming back. I'm rubbing the beginning of a mustache on the mic. It's coming back, people. It's coming back. The stash is coming back. Swordoftrust.com and WTFpod.com/tour. And now I'm going to play at first two chords, and then I'm going to add a chord, and then maybe one other chord, and it's going to have an echo on it, and then I'm going to stop playing guitar.